Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, Samantha Ege, an award-winning musicologist and celebrated concert pianist, talks about her first book, Southside Impresarios, How Race Women Transformed Chicago's Classical Music Scene. It was published in November 2024 by the University of Illinois Press. This book examines the lives of several pioneering Black women musicians and community leaders. So I asked Samantha Ege what inspired her to write what essentially is a biography of Black Chicago's classical music community.
Well, when I was an undergraduate student studying abroad at McGill University, I learned about this woman called Florence Price, who was the most prolific Black composer of her time. We're talking the 1930s and 40s. And as a woman of African descent studying classical music, this was the first time that I'd really seen what felt like an aspect of myself reflected in classical music. And so I just always sort of held on to her. I held on to the knowledge of her. And a few years later, I pursued the study of her as first a master's, which then became a PhD. And when I was doing my PhD and I was making these trips both to Arkansas, which is where Florence Price was born, and then Chicago, to which she migrated in 1927, I realized there was this even bigger story to tell in a way about her Chicago. And I always remember finding that my experiences in Chicago just gave me a sense of that much bigger story. And so I did the PhD, but while I was doing that, I was kind of like a squirrel, kind of collecting these ideas that would later become a book. And then I landed this incredible job at the University of Oxford, which really gave me the time, the resources, the confidence as well to really step into telling that story.
You know, that's interesting. You were born and raised where?
So I'm from the UK. I'm not from London, but we'll just say I'm from London just to make it easier. Yeah, so we have Samuel Coleridge Taylor, a mixed race Afro-British composer who was a real, I think, icon and a real inspiration for Black classical musicians, because he was able to navigate the classical sphere without Jim Crow. And when he would go to the States, because he was this exotic outsider, he could open doors and pave a way for Black classical musicians that, you know, those born in the US were unable to do. So it was interesting to think about that sort of transatlantic connection as I was doing this work. You know, what is my positionality as a Black British woman, as someone who's not American? And I really felt that sense of that collegial dynamic that Samuel Coleridge Taylor must have felt, you know, over a century ago, as he was also engaging in a broader sense of what it meant to be an African descended person operating in classical music.
Okay. Now, your study really looks at these dynamic and even pioneering Black women who made their mark in what has been called the Black Chicago Renaissance. What period is that for people who don't know? And how did it differ from, say, the Harlem Renaissance?
Yes. Yeah, so if you go to the more sort of classic texts on the Black Chicago Renaissance by especially Darlene Clark Hine, she has done incredible work to bring this era to light. Those texts will say that it was from around 1930 to 1950, which is after the Harlem Renaissance, which is seen as more sort of late 1910s into the 20s and kind of tapering off after that. But what was really interesting was getting into the classical music side of the Black Chicago Renaissance, because often that story is told through the literature, the poetry, sculpture. If music is featured, it's more the jazz and blues, right? Which makes sense considering the geography. But when you follow classical music in Chicago was taking shape in the late 19th century. And then you have someone like Nora Holt around 1917 proclaiming, in her own words, a Chicago Renaissance. So that language was being used even before the Harlem Renaissance, which I find really fascinating because that's when we're told, you know, that this movement takes off. Another comparison as well is that Harlem had a lot of white patronage. So you had people like Carl Van Vechten and different white patrons influencing in ways that are quite complex. You know, there was definitely appreciation, but degrees of appropriation. But essentially, I guess the more interracial dynamic generated different kinds of artistry, whereas Chicago's more segregated dynamic meant that there was greater self-sufficiency for Black classical Chicago. So you don't see white patronage feature as prominently, and that generates a different kind of ecosystem that is very distinct from Harlem. And I don't think it's in the shadow of the Harlem Renaissance at all.
And you begin your book by describing a truly historic event in June of 1933, featuring the symphonic work of Florence Price. So could you talk about why you chose to start at that point?
So I'd like to think that by now Florence Price is becoming a more familiar name. And I notice as well that every time I'm introducing Florence Price, I have this line, you know, Florence Price, the first Black woman to have a symphony performed by a major national orchestra. It kind of feels like a copy and paste. I'm saying that line all the time. So that's the narrative that we kind of start with. And that narrative has led people to think, wow, she was the only Black woman who wrote a symphony. You know, first doesn't mean only, and first also doesn't mean the first that was capable. It's all about opportunity. But because this is a, you know, it's a common narrative now for those of us who know who Florence Price is or who are just getting to know her. So I wanted to start with this story that's a bit more familiar to us, and then for us to kind of turn and look at the audience and to look at who's sitting where, who are the different people, who are the different stakeholders, and to get a sense of actually the fragmented nature of classical music in Chicago and, you know, a familiar term, the hidden figures. And so we begin with someone who's a little bit more familiar, and then we face the audience, and then we get into the names that we don't know, but as this book shows, we really should.
And it was the Chicago Symphony that played Price's work, right?
Yes, it was the Chicago Symphony. And I also think that it's very easy to give them too much credit for championing the work of a Black woman, because it was actually Black women that made that happen. And, you know, that is not a new story for Black classical musicians in Chicago who know this history, but it's not a mainstream story. It's not the narrative that people necessarily think of with that line, you know, Florence Price, the first Black woman to have a symphony performed by a major national orchestra. It puts the accolade a little bit too much towards the orchestra and their benevolence, as opposed to, well, first, why is she the first? Why has there hardly been anyone since? And how did she get there? And so my book is the story of how she got there.
Okay, so in talking about widening the gaze from just Florence Price to these other women who were dynamic and innovative in their own way, can you talk a little bit about who those other women were, composers first, and then the women who supported them and helped them to become the artists that they were?
Yes, definitely. So Florence Price mentored a younger composer called Margaret Bonds, and she has somewhat of an overlapping style to Florence Price in terms of quoting the spirituals and this very sort of lush compositional style. But because she's a generation later, she also absorbs a little bit more of the blues and the jazz that the older generations would have kind of looked down on a little bit. So she's a bit of a bridge really between worlds. And she's got some really fantastic pieces. Troubled Water is one of my favorite pieces by Margaret Bonds that I've actually recorded twice on two different albums. That's how much I love the piece. And then you've got Helen Hagen. So she lived in Chicago for a while, but she was the first Black woman to graduate from the Yale School of Music in 1912. And I had the immense privilege of playing the piano concerto that she composed during that time at Yale in the same concert hall where she performed it 110 years before me. So that was an incredible privilege. And she played that piano concerto in its two piano arrangement when she was living in Chicago. And on that program, is another name called Nora Holt, and she wrote about 200 compositions. But when she was studying abroad in Europe and she'd keep her pieces in storage, she came back and they had been ransacked. So only two of her compositions survive.
That's
Yeah,
criminal.
it's tragic. It is. It really is. But, you know, these are really interesting stories in the case of Helen Hagen, because even though it's not a symphony, she's writing symphonically decades before Florence Price has her breakthrough. And then Nora Holt, when she attended the Chicago Musical College, she's the first Black person, male or female, to graduate with a Master's of Music. Her thesis composition was a symphonic work. So it shows that given the platform, the opportunity and the resources, Black women will write symphonically. But the story of Florence Price shows that it took many factors in order for her to get that mainstream recognition.
Wow. Did Nora Holt's orchestral composition ever get performed?
I'm not sure if it got performed. That's something that I'm going to have to dig into. But she attended Western University in Kundaro, which no longer exists, but she wrote the music for their school anthem. And so I've seen the lyrics. Unfortunately, I haven't seen the sheet music. But, you know, that's the story of these women, in that they are everywhere. And yet what they need are those institutions and those infrastructures that will collate all their materials. You know, these women kind of exist in these scattered archives, which makes it very difficult to tell their stories. You know, it has the effect of making it seem like women weren't doing, or Black women, I should say specifically, weren't doing all the things that we know that they were doing. But we come away with that impression simply because they are not afforded the privilege of, you know, archival remembrance.
Right. Speaking of archives, you write a lot about the Black society women who supported these women in terms of concerts and other ways. So first, who were these women, and then how did you find out about them?
So the woman that underwrote the Chicago Symphony concert is a woman called Maud Roberts George. And in her time, she was a celebrated soprano who broke color barriers in Chicago itself. But then when she got married, so she married a judge, meaning that, you know, it reflects the fact that she was a society woman. These women married well, they married strategically, they married so that they could pursue their own passions. And Maud Roberts George switched into music journalism. And so when I was doing my research solely on Florence Price, I would look to the Chicago Defender and I would see that pretty much all of the articles about Florence Price were written by this woman called Maud Roberts George. And on the cover of the book, you have Maud Roberts George there, and about two seats over, you've got Florence Price. So, you know, outwardly, it looks like these women are, you know, kind of just objectively writing about each other. But there's this interior sisterhood where they know how much it means to get the names and the stories in print. Maud Roberts George succeeded Nora Holt at the Chicago Defender. Nora Holt was the first music critic for the Chicago Defender. And so she really sort of laid that foundation in terms of writing about classical music, because she could have written about popular music, but it was a choice in line with, you know, the thinking about racial uplift and how do we uplift the people and educate, you know, and those who do not have access to concert halls, how can we create experiences where people feel enlightened? And it's not to say that that ideology wasn't problematic in any way, but there's this intention of building community, of building uplift through music criticism. And so the women that succeeded Nora Holt really embodied that spirit. Nora Holt also co-founded the National Association of Negro Musicians out of her home, which highlights the importance of the home as well as the music club. So all of these spaces away from the very oppressive classical music strictures were so important for building self-esteem, to the point that you get a young Margaret Bonds growing up with no sense of inferiority because of how well her ecosystem has shielded her and protected her and uplifted her. I think of her as a daughter of the Black Chicago Renaissance.
Okay. And it's interesting too that in addition to the Chicago Defender archives, the repository of all of the papers dating back to its earliest days, you had to really combed through several different types of archives and archival institutions. So where did you go to deal with the research that you obviously did a great job of in
Thank you.
bringing these women's lives to light?
Yes, so Fayetteville, Arkansas, where the Florence Price materials are, Chicago, where the Center for Black Music Research is, the Amistad Research Center as well in New Orleans, which I didn't expect to have to go there for work on Chicago, but you never know where these things
That's
are going
true.
to end up. So that was really great because they had the Chicago Music Association papers, which was really helpful because certain things clicked, especially around Marian Anderson's story. That was a really great moment to be there and feel certain things come together. But also, I looked for different kinds of sources. So there's a photo of Katharine Dunham in a moment of her choreography as well. And so I looked at what that could tell us about these women. I also feature programs of concerts, and there's one program that actually has patronage. So you can see how Black women, in particular, generally married to wealthy men, are able to support this network. I think it's important to think about marriage not just in the traditional domestic sense, but as a form of strategy, a really, really important strategy for women to find agency, even if it was through marriage. But Nora Holt is someone who completely tore up that script and did it her own way.
You're all over the place.
Yes.
That's great. In terms of research, you also include a few excerpts from the musical scores of Nora Holt, Florence Price. So, because obviously you have people who are going to read your book who are not musicians and are interested in these the stories of these women, but then you obviously will have people who have some musical training who will be reading. So, I guess the question is, what made you decide to include some scores, and how did you select, since at least with Florence Price, you had a wealth to pick from?
Yes, I mean, that was the difficult question. And I think that being a music historian, if I didn't have musical examples from the musicology corner, that was going to be the first criticism, So, but I guess I wanted the book to serve different kinds of purposes because I'm a concert pianist. I talk about performance a little bit, but considering that performance is maybe at this stage, probably about 50% of what I do, it's not 50% of the book. So I wanted the musical examples to not necessarily be a case of, and here's another piece by Florence Price, and here's another piece by. I wanted it to be part of extending the narrative. So if it is a bit too technical for some readers, I think that you won't lose a sense of the storyline. If you feel that you have to skip over that, I don't think that you're going to miss too much. But if you're familiar with musical analysis and with the notation, I think it will then offer a different perspective. So, for example, with Florence Price, the piece that I chose was her Fantasie Nègre in E minor, which was the first piece I ever heard by Florence Price. And I do mention that that was actually the piece that made me see I can be a pianist, I can be a musicologist. So it had a lot of personal significance to put that one in there. But also beneath the title, it says, "To my talented little friend, Margaret Bonds." And so even if you're not reading the music itself, you get that it's a piece about sisterhood. You get the general gist of it. The other piece by Florence Price I included is one that I didn't know existed until a few years ago. In fact, most people don't know it exists, but it's a piece called Chicago. And I wanted to analyze it in a way where I could describe what the music sounded like without using too many technical terms. But actually, that's one of my favorite parts of the book because of all the pictures. I love the pictures in that section. And so, even if the analysis isn't fully translating, hopefully the pictures make up for it. So, sort of a trade-off. But yeah, as a musicologist, I had to put some music in there.
I'm not mad at you. It's great. How much knowledge did you have of Chicago and its Black South Side before you started this project? Because obviously, you're not from the city, you're not from this country. And so to come in and have to deal with navigating both the city as well as other cities to do your research could be a bit daunting. So how did you deal with that?
Yeah, I had zero knowledge. I'd never been to Chicago until I started this work. And I guess it really just started from looking at who were the women in this network. You've got Florence Price at the epicenter, and then sort of looking out and around her. And then in 2019, I got a fellowship to do some research at the Newbery. And they have this really incredible cartographic collection. And that's when I really started getting into maps. And so, in an article that I did that is sort of a very light version of the book, I had maps in there. They were kind of a different quality to the maps that are in this book. But it was the beginning of tying in geography and music making. And then I remember, let's see, it would have been the same, or maybe it was around that time, because it was my 29th birthday, and I got Michelle Obama's memoir, Becoming. And what really struck me was that moment where she's talking about her piano lessons, and she's talking about her Aunt Robbie. And I began to make that connection that Aunt Robbie was a little bit like these race women using classical music to empower. And then there's an anecdote that I actually put in the book where Michelle Obama talks about going into a downtown concert space, basically. And it's so different to what she knows. The piano is so different to what she knows, to the point that she can't even find middle C. And for me, that was just such a vivid portrayal of these distinct geographies and the disorienting nature of such segregated geographies. So just to read it in her sort of, contemporary context, and then to think back to these women, these connections began to make sense. And then I would also add, the first kind of major performance opportunity I had was through the African American Network, which I talk about in the book. And a consistent thing is that these women pull me into their geography. Playing the music in Chicago or playing Helen Hagen at Yale, it feels so different, and it feels almost spiritual. It feels like such a blessing. Like they've said, this is your reward for persevering. We're going to bring you into this space so that you can perform our music. It feels incredible. And so I just feel that, I just have to keep pursuing it.
Let me ask you then, too, given that you were talking about so many different women, the musicians, the society women who supported them, the journalists who wrote about them, how did you organize all that material?
Yes. One thing that I began to identify is that I have a bit of a cyclic storytelling method. So I will take one event and then travel around it from different perspectives. And I think that's kind of what happened with this book. So, beginning with that familiar Florence Price story. And then the first chapter is about, well, okay, so I'm using this term race women. What is a race woman? Let's start there. Okay. And then with the next chapter, it's what is the Black Chicago Renaissance? And then what is geography? And so we're taking these different terms and looking at classical music making from these different perspectives. And then in the second half, I wanted us to then come back to Florence Price and say, okay, we now have this information about her. Let's get back into the story and better understand basically what I talked about at the beginning. We're going to go back there, but with, this new newfound knowledge.
Okay. And then you end the book with a chapter that's really devoted to Maude Roberts George.
Yes.
You start with the musician and you end with a woman who also was a singer, musician, but she really is known more for her journalistic skills. Is that
Yeah.
accurate? So it's interesting that you decided to have that juxtaposition. Is that something that you knew from the beginning that you how you wanted it to end, or it kind of organically came out of the writing?
I would say it organically came out of the writing. And then also the style in which I wrote the conclusion was an experiment, because I had long known that Maude Roberts George had, quite a sad end. And the more I spent time reading through that, the more I realized that I think it's a lot sadder than it seems. And so I figured, I don't think I can write about this in that sort of third person distance, Because the other side of it is that I didn't want this to be a narrative about Black women's struggle where there wasn't struggle necessarily. And so writing everything else in the third person worked well. But for this part, it felt a lot more personal. So I wrote the conclusion in the second person. Then I went back and I wrote it in the third person. I thought, oh no, 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 that won't work. That just sounds cold. And I kept it the way that it was. And I think that conclusions are very difficult to write because that's the moment where it's done. There's nothing more that you can say. But I was conscious of the symmetry as well. And so I guess picking up on her, where she's this figure that emerges towards the end of the introduction and then making her the focal point, just really seemed to make sense, as opposed to a rather more academic conclusion that goes, well, this is what I've said, and I'll just say it again one more time, and now we're done.
And since this is your first book, what words of wisdom might you offer to other writers who might be beginning their own biographical research and writing journey?
I would say when it comes to biography, it really helps if you feel a point of connection to the person that you're writing about. And I think I'm lucky because I wasn't writing about any sort of horrific person in the past. So I guess it depends on who you're writing about, but to be able to write lovingly felt incredibly special. And it's not to say that I'm writing with bias, because there are absolutely times when I challenge who these women were and what they stood for. But I hope that that sense of care comes across in telling this story. So yes, it depends on whose story you're telling. But just, I guess, from a less personal standpoint, I would also say that sometimes you don't know what the book is about until you've written it. And I had these different sort of post-its to remind me of different things. And one of them said, if you think about it, write about it, you know, just get it out. There's so much that I cut from the book. And now that I've cut it, I don't miss it. But if you do think about it, you just have to write it down, because it's better to work with too much than to, you know, have the ideas swimming around in your head. And another thing that I constantly remind myself is that there's no substitute for the work. So if you're just talking about your book, you know, it's not a book until you actually write something. So just write it. There's a Toni Morrison quote that I'm not going to get exactly, but she says she used to be scared in starting out with an idea, but now she knows that it's fine because you can revise it and you can figure out everything that you wanted to say and say even better. And that's, as she said, it's a beautiful stage to get to. So just if you think about it, write about it, and then deal with it later.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Samantha. I really appreciate this.
Yes, thank you.
That was author, artist, and music scholar Samantha Ege speaking with me about her first book, Southside Impresarios, How Race Women Transformed Chicago's Classical Music Scene. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in November 2024, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in January of this year. To learn more about Bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.